The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Well, migrants also feature in the story of the subject of our next guest's book. John Walsh is the author of the newly released biography of Peter Sutherland. Sutherland, in the public sector, was instrumental in shaping the global economy. He worked in the private sector too, as chairman of BP and chairman of Goldman Sachs International, earning a reported €120 million as chairman of Goldman. He was given the moniker the globalist after the success of his work on the Uruguay round of global trade negotiations in 1993. It was the biggest trade agreement in history, establishing the World Trade Organization, and he was chosen by the Clinton administration's Mickey Cantor to chair those talks. John Walsh, let's start just with those talks. You've called the book The Globalist. Obviously, there must have been a huge amount of charm, diplomacy and schmoozing needed to win people over. But those talks could easily have fallen apart, couldn't they, at any point? In other words, he had to be able to do a certain amount of knocking heads together, and he was capable of being tough and firm as well.
Well, it's funny, a lot of the skills he picked up in the law library, persuasion, gentle cajoling, bullying, downright bullying, and even at sometimes the threat of physical violence. I mean, these talks had been going on for 7 years. Sutherland didn't actually take up the role until the beginning of June 1993. So it was 6 months he had to complete this agreement. He travelled to these countries. He travelled to meet all the prime ministers. You know, he cajoled them. He did everything. It was a big charm offensive. You know, he was very tough when he needed to be. Even Mickey Cantor complained that he could have been too tough at times, and he felt he was being bullied. But Sutherland managed to get them all going in the same direction.
But it nearly fell apart at the end.
Yeah, then December 1993, he managed to get every country to agree a broad outline of a trade deal. You know, the press conference was called for the morning of the 15th of December. Then the night before, the Japanese ambassador threw a wrinkle in the works. He said, the anti-dumping measures, we can't agree to these. Now, if they reopened negotiations on anti-dumping, it's like the domino effect. Then everything could have been potentially open. You could have unraveled 7 years of negotiations there and then. Those present in the room, say, Sutherland asked, could he have a private word with the Japanese ambassador in the green room adjacent to the main meeting room. There was apparently a lot of roaring and shouting, all of it coming from Sutherland. He asked the Japanese ambassador for the phone number of the Japanese prime minister because he was going to bring him there and then and blame him for collapsing these talks. The Japanese ambassador refused to give him the phone number. Sutherland just said to him, look, if you want to publicly object to these talks, you're going to have to, but I'm going ahead. Sutherland went back out, announced the deal. The Japanese ambassador didn't say a word. And that's how he got it over the line.
He railroaded it through. Margaret Thatcher once referred to him as that man in Europe. Why?
Yeah, in a way it's fascinating because if you look at what Sutherland was sent to Europe to do, in January 1985 he took up his role as European Commissioner. At the time, the single market was in name only. All member states had their own vested interests, they had their own trade barriers. Europe wasn't really working economically. Thatcher was, you know, she was fed up with this. She was really frustrated. She wanted a single market for UK goods. At the time, if you wanted a single market, you needed to go to every member state and break down their barriers. That's why when Sutherland got the competition portfolio, it was absolutely crucial.
He was European Commissioner with responsibility for competition.
And it was his job. When he was in Brussels in 1985, he was given one brief, look, just break down the barriers to trade. And the most enthusiastic supporter of this was Thatcher. She wanted a single market. Now, I don't think anybody expected how successful Sutherland would be. Again, he was like a bulldozer. He wouldn't take no for an answer. He went up against the big guys. He took on France, he took on the UK, he took on Germany, and in most cases he prevailed. And as he recounted himself some years later, he was shaving one morning in Brussels listening to the BBC, and Thatcher was on for an interview, and she was asked about interest rates, and she goes, I'm not here to talk about interest rates, I'm here to talk about that man in Brussels, referring to Sutherland. And the thing was, she wanted a single market, but she just didn't want to abide by any of the rules and regulations needed for a single market to operate and thrive.
Now, one of the other things, because so much of his career related to Europe and issues around that, he had his own views around Brexit. We have a clip here of him just before the Brexit referendum actually talking about what might happen if there was a Brexit referendum and if it was passed. And this was his view.
My own view is that our predominant concern has to be the European Union. And therefore, whilst one should accommodate and facilitate and help the British as best we can, there is a line beyond which we should not cross. And anything that is a challenge to the essence of the European project, we should reject in the negotiations.
So he really was the ultimate Europhile.
He really believed in Europe. He believed that European integration was the best way of taking on the downside of nationalism. And, you know, if you look at when he became ill, he had a heart attack in September 2016. Just before it, he had a Brexit vote. And just afterwards, he had the election of Donald Trump, one on an anti-migration platform and the other one on an economic nationalism platform. And he was implacably opposed to both.
He must have come across Boris Johnson at some point, in Johnson's writing journalism days.
Yeah, he did. There was one incident when he was the chairman of the London School of Economics. He chaired a debate in 2013 when Boris Johnson was one of the headline speakers. Now, Johnson didn't really address Europe in the body of his speech, but at the Q&A session at the end, when he was actually Mayor of London at the time, there was a few questions about Europe, and, you know, he came across with his trademark Eurosceptic comments. But afterwards they went for dinner, and Sutherland was sitting beside Johnson, and, you know, they discussed the evening and what was said, and Johnson remarked, he said, well, you know, this Euroscepticism is a bit of fun, really. I'm actually a bit of a Europhile. And it was something that really played in Sutherland's mind. And then when it came to the Brexit debate and when Johnson took such a prominent role in the Leave side, you know, Sutherland confided in a lot of friends, he just couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe a referendum of this importance for the future of not just for Britain, but for the EU as well. It could be conducted in such a glib manner, and how one of the main proponents wasn't necessarily a committed Eurosceptic.
And the rest, they say, is history, that one. And more recently, he was given this UN role to look at the whole question of migration and refugees. And we have a clip of him here speaking on RTE where he talks about how Europe should view the refugee crisis that was happening just a few years ago.
Virtually all the Central and Eastern European countries are saying absolutely no to refugees. Surely if we are a community, a European Union, based with the concept of solidarity, we should share, and we should share on a logical basis, all the refugees.
That view about Europe and the refugees is pretty consistent with his worldview, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. He believed in an international rules-based system. That didn't just apply for the movement of goods. It also applied for the movement of people, and in particular migration. He was quite often misrepresented towards the end of his life as, you know, as being as this advocate for open borders and doing his best to dismantle the nation state. In fact, he never advocated that. It's not something he wanted. What he wanted was a rules-based system for migration, where countries cooperated with each other and they ensure that migration is done on a safe and orderly basis.
He had a good sense of humour. I met him, I'd say, probably twice and would have enjoyed conversations with him. But before I met him, I had this idea that he was the sort of the ultimate suited patrician corporate world executive who'd been, you know, chairman of BP. But when you actually talk to him, he was mad for a bit of chat, a bit of gossip, a bit of fun. He had a good sense of humour.
Oh, very much so. I mean, he was a much more nuanced personality than, you know, was often depicted. You know, he became
the ultimate fat cat banker,
yeah,
was what some people would have said.
And a lot of people wanted to believe that because he became a very convenient target. But when you got to know him, like, he was much more complex. You know, his views were very nuanced. He believed in capitalism, but he believed in responsible capitalism.
Well, it was a fascinating career, a fascinating life, and it's a fascinating book. John Walsh, author of The Globalist. Thanks for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.